It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. C. L. Gray, founder of Physicians for Reform. His topic is Post-Hippocratic Medicine under the Affordable Care Act, our seniors as a negative economic unit.
Boy, it's an honor and a privilege to be here, and thank you so much for your time and today and tomorrow and coming and all that you do to help move this effort forward. I'd like to talk today a little about the bigger picture. What's going on with the healthcare system, and how does it relate to the passions that you all have here at this conference, and what's happening at the beginning of life, and what's happening at the end of life, and really what are the forces behind that? And I titled my talk Post-Hippocratic Medicine under the Affordable Care Act. I actually gave this first lecture back in 1999, and then I had called it Post-Hippocratic Medicine in the Shadow of Nietzsche, saying what was going to come. And what I'm going to do today is tell you that story. Barbara Wagner was a 64-year-old gal, lived in Oregon, and she had lung cancer, recurrent lung cancer, and went to see her oncologist. And he recommended treatment with a new chemotherapy drug called Tarceva. Well, she didn't have insurance, and she ended up falling under the Oregon health plan, because Oregon, like every other state, is trying to struggle with this issue of what to do with the rising number of uninsured. Well, because she was under the Oregon health plan, she went to get her chemotherapy. But instead of getting her chemotherapy, it turns out she couldn't, she got a letter from the state of Oregon stating that they would pay for either hospice or for physician-assisted suicide. She appealed that once and lost the appeal. She appealed a second time, and they denied her. Essentially, you know, government compassion sounds so noble, but in the end, whoever pays holds the power to choose. See, the problem with this Oregon health plan is they had run out of money, and they're starting to have to make this decision of who's going to get what care, because they didn't have enough money to pay for everything for everyone. And there's a transfer of power that moved that healthcare decision-making decision from the patient and the physician to those administrating the system. The second story I tell was about a book I read back in my medical training. This is back in the mid-1990s. It's written by Peter Singer. How many know who Peter Singer is? Yeah, this room is very familiar with him. And the title of the book, as you see, is Rethinking Life and Death, The Collapse of Our Traditional Ethics. And in this book, he struggles with the rising cost of health care. And one of the proposals he makes is that we should change the definition of human life, that humans aren't, quote, fully human until the fifth week of age. So if an infant is born with a disability, they can be put to sleep, or he's really introducing the concept of infanticide. And his argument is that if we have kids with disabilities, they cost a lot of money to get to care for. He said if we don't have those kids with disabilities, we can save that money and invest it in kids that are more gifted. And if those kids that are more gifted, you know, get more funds, you know, they can do better in life. And this makes for a much more effective and efficient practice of medicine. And that disturbed me. I was giving a talk at the end of my medical training. And there's it's something called a grand rounds. It's a formal lecture to the residents and attending staff and nurses. And this was in upstate New York, and it was a pretty leftist-center group. So I started with the question, how did America reach a place in her history where one of our leading bioethicists could seriously propose the concept of infanticide to reduce the rising cost of health care? And if you wind the clock back, this is 1990s. So this is quite some time ago. So to answer that question, I went back and read some 50 or 60,000 pages of history and philosophy, trying to find out what pushed America to the place where we're starting to consider, seriously consider, something that we once thought unthinkable. And that's the story I'm going to tell you now. Our story actually begins back in ancient Greece with the two thinkers, Plato and Hippocrates. Hippocrates is born about 460 B.C. Plato was born about 427. And they both address the role of the physician in culture. If you read through Plato's Republic, he talks about the physician. And he says, quote, but bodies that disease has penetrated through and through, the physician would not have attempted to cure. He, being the physician, did not want to lengthen out good-for-nothing lives or to have weak fathers begetting weaker sons. If a man was not able to live in the ordinary way, he, being the physician, had no business to cure him. For such a cure would have been no use either to himself, or note these last four words, or to the state. So here we have a thinker, Plato, a very serious thinker, seriously proposing that the role of the physician is start to look at patients not in terms of individuals, but who's benefiting society and who's a burden on society, and to start to make that decision-making process based on that. He goes on to say, these practices will treat the bodies and minds of your citizens who are naturally well endowed. As for the rest, those with poor physical constitution will be allowed to die. And those with, you have to appreciate the poetry of Plato, and those with irredeemably rotten minds will be put to death. Okay, it sounds in some ways kind of funny the way he says it, but you think about it, now that's a serious statement of policy, of philosophy, where he's saying the physician is to look at the citizens who are well endowed, they get treatment, they're benefiting society, and you look for people that have poor physical constitution or not contributing to society, and those are killed or let die. So it really starts to differentiate between people in how they're treated. So Hippocrates had a completely different approach. And on breath, he says, the physician sees terrible things and touches on the loathsome, and from others' misfortunes harvests troubles of his own. So here we start to see something about the patient-physician relationship, element of compassion. In his oath, he says, I will not give a poison to anyone who asks to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan. In the same way, I'll not give a pessary to a woman to cause an abortion, but in purity and in holiness, I will guard my life and my art. Let's take a little time out and look at that first sentence. I will not give a poison to anyone who asks to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan. And we wonder, well, why would Hippocrates say that? Well, in ancient Greece, they, as we do today, struggle with pain control. So sometimes there'd be a patient that had unrelenting pain from, you know, a cancer, cord compression, or neuritic pain. And they come to their doc and say, Doc, I can't get rid of this pain. I can't live with it. Can you give me something so I can end my life? Let me escape this pain. And even in that context of unrelenting pain, Hippocrates says, I will not give a poison to anyone who asks to do so. The question then is why? Why would Hippocrates say that? Well, it turns out Hippocrates is a Pythagorean. And we know Pythagoras as a mathematician, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. If we go back long enough ago, we remember that that formula. Well, he's also a philosopher. And at the base of Pythagorean philosophy was the concept that human life is special. Human life is a gift from the gods. Of course, he was Greek, and his thing was from the Greek gods. But he thought there's this higher moral code that they were to follow. That human life was supposed to be held and defended. That there was something intrinsically special about being human. So we see this in that last line, but in purity and in holiness, I will guard my life and my art. And this gets down to the difference in worldviews between Plato and Hippocrates, where Plato, if you read through the Public, I wish we could have an hour just to talk about Plato. He searches for God, but he can't find him. And when he can't find God, he sort of falls back to his definition of good as the good of the collective, the good of the state, where Hippocrates believes that the gods have given something special to man, and then he works out of that worldview. So we see this also in precepts where Hippocrates says, for if love of men is present, love of the art is also present. So here we see sort of a moral compass for medicine. And it's sort of like a compass instead of a north and a south. we have an H and a P, Hippocrates and Plato. So if we start to think about this moral compass in a bit of a timeline, in ancient Greece, the needle starts sort of pointing over here towards P. Then over the next 300 years or so, this needle swings over towards H, and you kind of imagine why it would do so, through simple free market forces. Imagine if you're a patient in ancient Greece, and you're getting up in age, and your knees hurt, and your back hurts, and your neck hurts, and you need to go see a physician. And which physician are you going to go see? The Hippocratic physician that's going to treat you to the best of their ability, or the Plato's ideal physician that's going to kill you or let you die? So most patients want to be cared for, so they go see the Hippocratic physician. So the culture sort of swings, and medicine follows Hippocrates for about the next 2,000 years. And in fact, here's a slide from a 14th century Christianized version of the Hippocratic Oath. And you can sort of see why this would be. After the Edict of Milan in 313 AD, there's sort of this rising influence of Christianity in the West. And Christian theology matches Pythagorean philosophy very closely. Now, we move from polytheism to monotheism, but still there's this concept after Augustine of the Imago Dei, the image of God. And as part of our core Christian belief, is we're special. So the West sort of adopts Hippocratic philosophy and the Hippocratic Oath. So the needle stays pointing over here towards H up until we get to the late 1800s. And here's a German writer, German thinker, Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche. And he actually writes about the moral code for physicians. But before we get that, does anybody remember sort of the most famous short sentence, three words from Nietzsche? God is dead, yeah. So Nietzsche says, you know, let's get rid of God. All right, I'm going to invent this thing on my own. So once God's out of the way, he says, I'm free to sort of create my own morality. And part of that morality deals with the physician. In Twilight of the Idols, section 36 says, is titled specifically, A Moral Code for Physicians. What we're looking for here is patterns in thought. So I'll read through this this bit here, and we're looking for patterns in thought. He says, quote, the invalid is a parasite on society. In a certain state, it is indecent to go on living, to vegetate down in cowardly dependence on physicians and medications after the meaning of life, even the right to life, has been lost, ought to entail the profound contempt of society. Very different than we saw with Hippocrates. He goes on to say, physicians, in their turn, ought to be the communicators of contempt. Not prescriptions, but every day a fresh dose of disgust for their patients. All right? It seems like he's a little out there, but again, this guy's a serious thinker. All right? Behind this, and I say it a little bit mockingly, but this is a serious guy that even today, a lot of people respect as one of the greatest thinkers of the last millennia. But notice what he says. Physicians ought to be the communicators of contempt. Okay, that's very, very different than what we thought the practice of medicine has been here in America. He goes on to say that to create a new responsibility, that of the physician, in all cases in which the highest interest of life or the ascending life, and I'll take a little time out again, when you read through Nietzsche, what's the ascending life? What's the young, the strong, the fit, those that are moving society forward, okay? Those that are benefiting the collective. This demands the most ruthless suppression and sequestration of degenerating life. A little time out again. What's the degenerating life? It's the elderly. It's the infirm. It's the sick. Those that are a burden on society. Okay? Again, we see the same discrimination in patients that we saw with Plato. For example, in determining the right to reproduce, the right to be born, in fact, even the right to live. Okay? So he's starting to place judgment on patients, on individuals, based on their productivity or burden to society. So, you know, we can just start with this needle pointing towards P. It's swung over towards H for about 2,000 years, late 1800s. Now it's back towards P. And we see the thinking of Nietzsche, reflected in the rise of the Third Reich. Beside me here is a picture of the Dachau hypothermia experiments. And the Dachau hypothermia experiments were supposedly done to learn how to rewarm down pilots suffering from hypothermia. So what they would do is they'd take their victim or their subject, immerse them in vats of ice water, nearly freeze them to death, and then rewarm them using various methods. Sometimes they'd place them under scalding lamps and burn their skin, or put tubes down through their esophagus and pour in hot water and scald their stomach, or up through their rectum and scald their colon, or open their abdominal cavity, pour in hot water and scald their intestinal tract, or dip them in vats of hot oil and burn them. The victims that survived would be nearly refrozen again and put through the torture one more time. So and this, sadly, is only one of many, many, many medical atrocities that, to me, even sadder as a practicing physician, that physicians were part of this. So following World War II, we see this try to be reversed with the Geneva Convention. There's part of the Geneva Convention that dealt with the medical ethics. And what they specifically tried to do, because we've seen this needle wander over towards B, they very explicitly try and re-anchor Western medicine back to its Hippocratic roots. Really what we're seeing today in the healthcare debate is this needle swinging and is kind of is hanging almost dead center. And the question we have for culture, the question we have for Americans that we need to answer, that our society needs to answer, will we let this needle swing back towards P, or will we pull it back towards H? And let me show you how it's sort of changed course here in the last 60 years. The first change was 1949 with the Geneva Convention itself. It didn't include an oath. We think about what's an oath. Well, it's a swearing before one's God or gods to hold a certain set of ideals for all time. When we get back to that worldview piece, what does that assume? That there is a God, that there is a truth, that there is this higher moral code that we're subject to. There's truth outside of ourselves. But the thing is the Geneva Convention didn't include an oath. It was more like a list of standards open to revision. And revision is exactly what we've seen. 1960, the World Medical Association changes the wording of the Geneva Convention, where instead of human life being sacred from conception, that was sacred from the beginning. And we can start to see postmodern thought enter in. Now we can start to debate when human life really begins. 1973, the needle swings a little further. And everyone here knows that's when abortion was legalized here in the United States. 1985, Peter Singer writes a book called Should the Baby Live? Now, listen for patterns in thought. He says, quote, "We think that some infants with severe disabilities should be killed. This recommendation may cause particular offense to readers who were themselves born with disabilities, perhaps even the same disabilities that we're discussing." So this means that there's people reading his books, attending his lectures, arguing with him intellectually, and he says perhaps they shouldn't have been left alive at all. You know, it's kind of rather convenient if you just don't let your opposition live, then you usually win the argument. So that's 1985, and the needle continues to swing. 1994, he publishes the book Rethinking Life and Death. And I had no idea when I read this book at the time, it changed the course of my life. Just a little aside, I used to be, well, still am, relatively quiet. I get nervous and break out in sweat just in my own Sunday school class trying to talk. I had no idea this book would turn me into a national public speaker. So that was something I had to work on. Anyway, listening for patterns in thought. He says, quote, "We suggest a period of 28 days after birth that might be allowed before the infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. This is clearly before the infant could have a sense of its own existence over time and allow a couple to decide that it is better not to continue a life that has begun very badly." Kind of makes you think of the lives that are not worth living. It also takes me back to that presidential discussion, Saddleback Church, 4 or 5 years ago, when our president was asked, when does the infant or the fetus gain the constitutional rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? Does that ring a bell with some of the folks here? And you recall his answer? Yeah. It's above my pay grade. So now we're starting to question when life really becomes life. When life really starts to be something that's worth living. And he's suggesting, Peter Singer, that, and if you read more of the book, he says, you know, 28 days, I'm really safe with that number. It may be much longer than that. But he says that 28 days, nobody can argue with me that 28-year-old or 28-day-year-old infant can really be processing the meaning of life. And the needle continues to swing. 1997, physician-assisted suicide is legalized in Oregon. 1999, Peter Singer is appointed to the Ira W. DeCamp Chair of Bioethics at Princeton University. And it's interesting as I go through this slide, I gave my first speech about 2 months after that appointment. So this is when I engaged this fight. This is what I saw. At this point, I haven't mentioned the Clintons, the Bushes. You know, this isn't about politics. This is about the flow of thought through history. This is about what worldviews, cultures use to start to make decisions, and those are reflected in public policy. 2008, the needle continues to swing. The Oregon Health Plan refuses Barbara Wagner chemotherapy, instead offering physician-assisted suicide. January 31st, 2009, I'm going to slow down just a bit here because this is getting towards the end of the story, and this is very important. There's the National Institute of Health Director of Bioethics wrote a paper for The Lancet. The Lancet's a very well-respected medical journal, sort of on par with New England Journal of Medicine. And in this article, he introduces something called a complete live system. Okay, I'm going to read a little from this paper just to see what this complete live system is. He says, consideration of the importance of the complete live system also supports modifying the youngest first principle. I'll just pause again there. What's the youngest first principle? Well, in Western culture, it's almost part of our DNA. We value our kids. And why? It sort of makes sense. The future of a nation lies in the minds of our youth. We sort of see this in, what do we say if a house is burning down? Get the kids out of the bedroom. Or if a ship is sinking, what do we say? Get the women and children off board. Fascinating story behind that, but for sake of time, I'll pause on that one. But we've always valued our kids and our youth. And he's saying, consideration of the importance of the complete live system also supports modifying this youngest first principle by prioritizing adolescents and young adults over infants. Okay? We're going to start to change how we look at the youngest of those among us. He goes on to explain this. He said, adolescents have received substantial education and parental care. Investments that are going to be wasted without a complete life. Where he says infants, by contrast, have not yet received those investments. So his argument is, you know, by the time, you know, kids get to their late teens and 20s, you know, they've had parental care and food and school and instruction. Also turns out they happen to be, you know, equipped and able to work, starting to sound familiar, where they can move society forward, okay? Society's invested 18 years of work into them, so now they can start to sort of repay what society's given them. He says this hasn't happened with infants. He said, when implemented, the complete live system produces a priority curve on which individuals between the ages roughly 15 and 40 years of age get the most substantial chance, little time out again, the most substantial chance of what? Well, specifically, this paper is written about how to allocate medical procedures and resources in an age where there's not enough money, or how to allocate medical procedures in an age of scarce resources. So he's saying, you know, if we don't have, and it kind of reminds you of Barbara Wagner, if we don't have enough money to pay for everybody, who's going to get what? Very important question, one we all need to be thinking about. And to his credit, he gives us his answer. Okay? So he says, when implemented, the complete lottery system produces a priority curve on which individuals between the ages roughly 15 and 40 years of age get the most substantial chance of a medical procedure in an age of scarce resources, just to make sure we're clear about what he's talking about, whereas the youngest and the oldest people, well, they get chances that are somewhat attenuated, okay? He goes on, unlike allocation by sex or race, allocation by age is not discrimination. All right? He doesn't want to be accused of discriminating. He says, treating 65-year-olds differently because of stereotypes, now that would be ageist. Yeah, we don't want to be ageist. But treating them differently because they have already had more life years is not. All right. Now, this next graph comes straight out of his paper. I haven't changed it a lick. Colors are the same, font's the same, just cut and paste. On the left, it's a little hard to see, I'm sure, from the back, but we have probability of receiving an intervention. Specifically, probability of receiving an intervention in the age of scarce resources. All right? And the bottom, we have age and years. The left is birth. So if you're born and need something to happen, the odds are kind of low that you're going to get that procedure. Sort of reminds you of Peter Singer, where for that first 28 days, you're not really fully human. So if you need something expensive, those people aren't going to get care. On the right, after about the age 55, your probability drops. Now, you might say, well, that's just one academic, and you can get all kinds of academics to say all kinds of crazy stuff. So what's the big deal about this one chart? Well, when I look at that, I see Plato. I couldn't think of how you graph the philosophy of Plato any better than this. I see Nietzsche. I see Peter Singer. So who was this? This was Ezekiel Emanuel that wrote this, and he's the brother of Rahm Emanuel, former White House Chief of Staff, and he was actually an advisor to President Obama to help design and implement the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So what he's done is he gives us his worldview, January 31st, 2009. So the country knew what his worldview was in development of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So we can see on the right there how you cut $716 billion from Medicare. It's right there on the right. You just limit medical procedures for seniors. So why concern ourselves with history and philosophy? It's because worldviews find their way into public policy. So for the next few minutes, I will check my time. I could talk for hours. Sometimes I do. So I've got a little time left. So February 17th, 2009, this was, within 3 weeks of President Obama's taking office, he passes something called the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research. Okay, this is stuff that was written long before he was sworn into office. So it had $1 billion of funding. It's 15 members were appointed within 3 days of signing the bill. And the Affordable Care Act created a multi-billion-dollar center to implement this. But I'm just going to briefly talk about the title here, Comparative Effectiveness Research. Now, as a scientist, I like to compare things. As a physician, I like them researched. And I want them to be effective. So I don't mind comparing things. I don't want them to be effective. And I spend the better part of my time in school doing basic science research. Love the title. The word that they didn't put in there is cost effectiveness, as we're going to see in just a moment. That same legislation also set up something called the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And it says, quote, it's to determine treatment at the time and place of care, and that, quote, physicians and hospitals that are not meaningful users of the system will face penalties. Okay, so they're going to start to coordinate what they consider cost-effective treatment. And now they have a way to have the health information technology to look at medical decision-making. All right? We'll see that in two sections of the bill. You know, I have gone to lectures where they try and describe the entire 2,700 pages of the Affordable Care Act, and two things happen. Either there's like 95% of the people just go to sleep, and then there's the other 5% who have their heads explode. So I'm going to kind of skip the review of the whole thing and just look at two sections. And what we're really looking for, and the details absolutely are important, but look for the general philosophy of what's happening. So section 3007, something called the value-based payment modifier. Okay, what is it? It says, quote, "The secretary shall establish a payment modifier that provides for a differential payment to a physician or group of physicians based on the quality of care furnished compared to cost." Okay, well, it's like, well, it's got to be written by a lawyer. Well, now, what did that mean? Well, you know, there's something about quality care, which I want, and there's something about cost, and goodness, we need to be thinking about cost, so maybe this isn't all that bad. Well, let's go through it again a little bit slower. The secretary shall establish. Those four words scare me to death. This is an unelected, unaccountable individual that can start to just do things on, at the moment, her own. So this time she gains the power to establish something called a payment modifier. Now, what's a payment modifier? Well, it's a way to withhold or reduce. This is looking primarily at Medicare patients. Kind of withhold some of the physician reimbursement. And just a reimbursement in the medical system is terribly confusing. I'm not sure anybody really understands it. But to make it simple, it's if you kind of look at it like a contractor, somebody that's going to go build houses. So a typical contractor will build a house for cost plus 12%. That's kind of a standard fee for contracting. And so let's say you want to go build a house. Say, like a $100,000 house. He says, well, it's going to cost $112,000. So you pull out your money and pay him. That's sort of like the insured patient. Medicare is sort of like cost plus 0%, where there's enough to cover the cost of seeing the patient, but there's really no extra at the end. There's no profit. It's sort of like the contractor saying, I'll build your $100,000 home for $100,000. I'm a really nice guy. I'll just build it at cost. She said, boy, that sounds like a great deal. But that contractor may be a really nice guy, but he won't stay in business. That's Medicare, and that's why seniors are having increased difficulty getting access to physicians. Medicaid is kind of like the contractor pulling out about $10,000, saying, you know, I'm a really nice guy. I'll pay your first $10,000 for you. I'll build that house for $90,000. So that's why Medicaid patients can't get in to see prime care physicians. Because it doesn't matter how nice that doc is, if they're losing money any time somebody comes in the door, they don't. So what happens to those patients? They end up in the emergency room, where cost of care is far, far more. So that's what's at stake here when it says the secretary shall establish a payment modifier, meaning she can withhold physician reimbursement for patients on Medicare, meaning she can put them into bankruptcy. Okay, that's really what that means. It's an enormous amount of power. Provides for a differential payment between physicians and groups of physicians based on quality of care furnished. That's why your physician now, every time you go see them, is spending all their time in front of a computer instead of talking to you, is because they have to enter all that data so they can look at their medical decision-making. Quality of care furnished compared to, there's the word, cost. All right, and it goes on, quote, "The term cost means expenditures per individuals as what? Determined appropriate by the secretary." So now she gets to say what kind of costs are appropriate. And if there's cost overruns on the part of the physician, she can punish them. This is the two pages of section 3007. I promise I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read the parts in red. "The secretary shall establish," is established by the secretary. "The secretary shall establish," is determined appropriate by the secretary. "Established by the secretary," determined appropriate by the secretary shall publish. "The secretary shall begin implementing," the secretary shall specify. "The secretary shall," the secretary shall, the secretary shall. 21 times in these two pages. How many of you were here this morning when we talked about the HHS mandate? Yeah. That was one. Of these thousands of the secretary shalls. You know, there's 2,700 pages of legislation, But there's probably now about 15,000 pages of regulation. So that 2,700-page bill was only a transfer of power with this huge amount of power being delegated to bureaucrats to say how this whole thing's going to work. Let's look at Section 3403, something called the IPAB. How many people have heard of the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board? This is a really a big, big deal, okay? Probably the worst part of the entire bill. I'll just say, tell you what exactly it says. Quote, purpose. It is the purpose of this section to reduce the per capita rate of growth of Medicare spending. So the IPAB is this panel established specifically to put a cap on spending for Medicare. It's 15 presidentially appointed independent experts. 2015, they can cap Medicare spending. But it's that last bullet that I want to spend just a moment on. The IPAB's recommendations become law unless overridden by two votes in the House and the Senate, three-fifths majority in the Senate. Now, I read through that two-vote thing and think, boy, that just sounds strange. What's going on? Well, it's actually very, very clever. Corrupt as all get out, but very, very clever. So the way it's set up is the IPAB makes a recommendation. Most advisory boards, I don't mind advisory boards, you know, we can't expect our congressional leaders to be experts on every subject. So there's subjects they don't know as much about, so they bring in boards to advise them, which is great. But usually that advisory board gives them advice. That advice is incorporated into legislation, and it has to pass the House, has to pass the Senate, and then be signed into law. Okay? So if it's really bad advice, hopefully somewhere in that process it's going to get stopped. This is completely different. This advisory board, their recommendations become law unless stopped. Okay? So they actually have legislative authority unless it's stopped by Congress. Now Congress has two votes. What's going on there? Well, the first vote is just to say it's a bad idea. And let's say, thinking back to Barbara Wagner, the IPAB recommends no chemotherapy that's too expensive for anybody over 65. You know, the American public could just, you know, have a meltdown. So Congress, you could get every senator, every person in the House to vote against it. But that still becomes law unless there's a second vote. Just voting it down is not enough to stop the thing. Congress has to come up with cuts of equal or greater value. And you can rest assured that there's no senator or House member that's going to go out and champion cuts worse than the IPABs. They're going to run from that as fast as they can. But what has this accomplished? It lets our congressional leaders come back and tell you, boy, that was a really bad decision. I did everything I could to stop it. But they know still full well it's going to become law. This is the kind of thing I would expect out of Stalinist Russia, not America. There's 15 people, they serve six-year terms, given legislative authority over Medicare, specifically tasked to cut it. And they don't have congressional oversight. They don't have executive oversight. You may think, oh, they're just pawns of the president. No, they're independent of the president. The president appoints them. But they don't have to get the president's approval for what they do. And the reason Congress thought this was such a good idea, and I agree with the first half of their logic, they said Congress is never going to cut health care spending. I mean, you look at their budget overruns now, they're crazy. So they said, well, if Congress is never going to cut it, the only way we can cut it is to transfer that power to people that don't have to face the voters. So now there's this 15-member panel that's given legislative authority to cut Medicare. Now let's think about the national debt. When that complete lives system was published in 2009, our national debt stood at $10.6 trillion. Today, I spoke at the Civil Rights Museum in North Carolina 3 weeks ago. This number 3 weeks ago was 16.5. I had to change my slide this morning, and every time I give this lecture, I change that slide. So we're now $16.7 trillion. So in the last 4 years, we've accumulated $6 trillion of debt. Now let's just look at interest on the debt. Right now, interest rates are sort of at historic lows. So we're paying about $250 billion a year on interest. But if interest rates go back to historic norms of 5 or 6%, that number climbs to $550, $650 billion a year to cover interest on the debt. You know, millions, billions, trillions, it's all confusing. What's $500 billion? 2011, Medicare cost $554 billion. Medicaid cost $407 billion. So we're looking at rapidly approaching a point where we're going to spend more money in interest on the debt when we pay for either Medicare or Medicaid. Erskine Bowles just gave a talk. He said by 2020, he expects it to be $1 trillion of interest a year on the debt. Look at this. Was published about a year ago. This is the red on the right is America. The left is all of Europe combined. That was when we were only at $15.1 trillion in debt. America has more debt than all of Europe combined. And worse, when you look at it on a per capita basis, each American holds more debt than the average European. And we're watching Europe go through this debt crisis now. Now let's take all that and cycle back through to Dr. Emanuel's complete live system. Now he published that when we were at, what, 10.6 trillion? So if he was worried about scarce resources then, you know, what's happening now? So as the government's starting to cut money and cut money and cut money, physicians are finally deciding we just can't practice medicine anymore. There's a poll taken of just over 5,000 physicians, and it wasn't a partisan poll. It was done by an insurance company, so it wasn't biased left or right. And it asked the question, is healthcare reform likely to lead you to retire over the next 5 years? That's an amazing question. 23.7, about 24% of docs said they are very likely to retire in the next 5 years because of this legislation. Another 19.2 said somewhat likely. So we're looking at a place where about 40% of docs are saying, I'm out of here. I just can't take care of my patients. They also asked the question, are you willing to suggest that your kids or friends go into medicine? 9 out of 10 docs now are saying, don't do it. Don't do it. Go do something else. So at a time we're looking at bringing, you know, some 20, 30 million new patients into the system, we're looking at losing, we won't lose 40% of docs. We might lose 10%, 15%. That's going to be very hard to care for patients. So is there another way forward? And I've spent the last 5-6 years working on public policy. And yes, the good news, I mean, this kind of leaves everybody depressed and wonder if there's going to be a future. But there is a way forward. Herman Cain, a friend of his, asked me to write a healthcare plan for his campaign. So I wrote something called Cutting the Gordian Knot, a patient-centered, fiscally responsible plan for healthcare reform. And I have a few copies out at the book table for a donation of $5. You can see that. And actually, I was just asked to write a paper for Ohio talking about Medicaid expansion. I'm asked to come back next Tuesday to testify in front of the healthcare subcommittee in the House about what to do with Medicaid. And most of this plan, this work, has to do with block grants for Medicaid because we have to fix the Medicaid system. One of the reasons I'm concerned about Medicaid is this was a chart that came out of Pennsylvania. I know it's very hard to read in the back, but essentially across the bottom is wages. It goes from zero to $100,000 a year. And that's that darker blue curve. It's that kind of smooth blue curve going up is wages minus taxes. The several bars on the left are various forms of social aid, various forms of whether it's health care or food stamps. What I notice when I look at this is this cliff right here and this cliff right here. This is our current social welfare system. What it does is it traps people in poverty. I look at that thing as a former engineer and saying, this is not going to work. Here it is. This is the key statement. A single mom is better off earning a gross income of $29,000 a year with income plus benefits of $57,000 than if she earned a gross income of $69,000 a year, $40,000 more with no benefits. So if a single mom, I think in that analysis she had three kids, But if she's making $29,000 a year, why on earth would she go get an education? Why on earth would she take a second job or pull extra shifts or try and get promoted from waiting to managing? Because as soon as she crosses this $29,000 line, she has less take home. So we need to fix that system, and this is the alternative that I'm presenting. So now there's a reason and an incentive and an ability for those people to move out of poverty. So and what I call is the elevator effect. Because we are probably the most compassionate nation on earth. We want to help our fellow American, but we want to help them improve their lives, not get stuck in poverty. So that's just one. I could talk about healthcare policy probably for another hour and a half. I'll cut myself off there. But this isn't just about healthcare. This is about a battle of worldviews where there, on one side, we follow our Judeo-Christian heritage, where there is a God. With a God comes there is a truth, what I call in the book a fixed truth. All right? This has to do with healthcare, the intrinsic dignity of life. It has to do with the courts. Is there such a thing as the fixed truth of a constitution? It has to do with Supreme Court justices. It has to do with public education. It has to do with foreign policy. So once you understand this battle of worldviews, this all gets reflected in what we see in this crazy, crazy culture war where the left hates the right with his visceral hatred. The right doesn't understand the left. They can't even talk to them. So why are we at such odds in the country? And that's what I deal with in cutting the Gordian knot. And one last effort that I wear about 50 different hats, but C.L. Bryant is a friend of mine. And how many have heard of the movie Runaway Slave? C.L. Bryant? It's an amazing story. And we go around speaking. He's a national black pastor. I'm a rather academic, soft-spoken white physician, kind of like Mutt and Jeff. He's one of the most eloquent speakers I've heard. We speak together. I kind of lay out the worldview piece, then he follows, and we take this message into the black churches. And it's amazing the response we get. So I spoke at one church in North Carolina. I spoke for an hour, and then the pastor said, can you speak for a second? I thought, well, okay. Spoke for a second hour, and then he said, can you speak for a third? But this is not the kind of church service I'm used to. And thank goodness somebody spoke up and said, no, we can't stay that long. I thought, good to go. But and there's a church I spoke to up in Delaware. There were about 200 people came out on a Thursday night. They came up and they hugged my wife and I, because this is about the value of the individual, the intrinsic dignity of the human. And that's a passion that the black church has. And Pastor Bryant and I are just encouraging them to vote their values. And the last piece is the DVD, but before I get there, let's take a little time for Q&A. Let me see what we have left here for time. So I think we have about 5 minutes for... Yeah, maybe five to seven minutes of Q&A, and then I'll play a little of the DVD. Because I wanted to show you a bit of the movie on what the time we had left. Because I think we need to be done by 5:15.
Yes.
Okay. So how about some... Do you have any questions? Sorry, I'm used to just taking from the audience. So.
Are there any physicians in Cleveland area who are not being turned, who have not been turning to electronic health records due to Obamacare? I'm sorry, I'm just having trouble reading their writing. So they want to know if someone's in this area who has not been going to these electronic health records due to Obamacare.
Yeah, that's the question is about the electronic medical record. And that's a very interesting situation, because there's essentially been money handed out to hospitals and physicians saying if you institute that now, the government will help pay for it. And the longer you wait to implement it, the less money the government will give you. So it's a bit of a bribe, saying get on board right away and we'll help cover the cost. It's still costing physician practices, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $150,000. I mean, they're very expensive to put in. And the only physicians that aren't doing that are the physicians that aren't taking Medicare, Medicaid. All right? So if a physician is willing to take Medicare, Medicaid, they essentially have to do it because they have to report all this stuff. Otherwise, they won't get paid. So they essentially have to place the electronic medical record.
Well, it just makes it just so much clearer. I was in D.C. This is off the questions a bit, and had to go into the doctor for my knee, and it just so happened to be the year that they had the 100 top surgeons and specialists in Washington on the cover of a magazine. And he said, what do they all have in common? And I'm thinking, I don't know. What do they all have in common? I mean, they had black ones and white ones and tall ones and short ones and lady ones and male ones and all types of doctors. He said, none of them take insurance. And I'm thinking Medicare and Medicaid. He said, no, not even private insurance. It's a cash business in Washington. They're hypocrites. What is your opinion on the idea of hospice hastening death? This question came up earlier, so if you could elaborate on this.
Yeah, hospice is, I've done hospice work for working on 20 years now. So hospice, I'm a strong advocate for hospice. I think to care for, I do hospital-based medicine and critical care. So I'm still seeing patients and families every day. I'm not on the road speaking. And because I do critical care, I see patients that are as sick as they get. And sometimes they pass away. That's what happens at the end of life. And so it's pretty common, almost routine for me to have end-of-life discussions with families. And it's very interesting watching culture and watching people of faith as I've trained in New York and now practice in North Carolina and just the faith aspect of it. But what seems very interesting to me is I oftentimes start out the conversation saying, has anybody ever talked to you about end of life? And they look at me and say, no. And I say, wow. So, okay, so then we start in. And there's two questions I always ask. And it's oftentimes when the loved one's unresponsive, maybe on a ventilator, maybe not, and saying, if they could wake up and stand here, what would they want me to do? And so it's not saying to the family member, what do you want me to do? But what does that patient, what does that loved one want me to do? And then I ask, are we doing these things for them to get them better back to their previous life? Or are we doing them to them for us? So I ask those two questions. It doesn't matter if it's cancer, if it's respiratory failure, if it's heart failure, or if it's something else. So that frames the discussion. And when I do my public policy work, the key point I want to make is that decision belongs between you and me, the patient, the families, and the physician, not Washington. So I say we have to have this discussion because if we don't, Washington will, I promise you. So I want that decision-making process left at the bedside. When you know that individual, you know the family dynamics, I know what's happening specifically with that patient, rather than some bureaucratic administrator saying anybody with these criteria gets help, anybody with those criteria doesn't, which is what I'm afraid of.
Well, I think earlier the question was framed a little differently, and perhaps someone here is struggling with their side of this question that you're asking, because often, you know, when it's time to go to hospice, maybe you should make a simple explanation of what is hospice. You have people that are now saying that they're given this choice, and they're not sure that this is the choice that is the only option on the table. And if someone's suffering, you don't want to make the decision based on that particular suffering or the fact that their life could be prolonged. Someone must be struggling. This question has come up many times.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I wish we had another half an hour.
Well, I know, it's a big question. And whoever's asking, perhaps you'd want to spend a little time with the doctor after, because this is, you know, as the baby boomers are aging, and as someone mentioned earlier, they're looking at after death, it's hard. These are hard questions for families.
That's a valid question, but I'd like to pick up on that comment. I'll try and get back to the question. This isn't an avoidance tactic. But the baby boomers are aging. What I see coming in the system that's being developed is it's seeds, I won't go to intentions, but for generational warfare. probably in the next 5 or 10 years, what I fear is the younger generation that's having to pay for all this crazy stuff is going to start to look at, until we get there, guys like me, and say, you know, you're just not worth it. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life working to pay for you. Let's get the seniors out of here. And the seeds are being sown now for generational warfare. So on the end of life issue, a lot of times, especially in a room like this, we can talk about it in terms of faith. In the Old Testament, there's this concept of toshavim, a Hebrew word. Anybody hear what toshavim means?
What?
Toshavim. It's a Hebrew word, means sojourner. We're passing through. This is not our home. There's a life on the other side of death, as C.S. Lewis would say, that is our homecoming. That it's appointed a time for man to be born, and it's appointed for man time to die. And we get to go home. We don't have to live with these bodies. So I very much respect human life for all the reasons I've argued today. But the value of human life doesn't mean that as a physician I need to do everything possible to prolong that life. And it's so different what I see. You know, we do CPR. You know, we break ribs. We shock people. We put tubes down their throats. It's not pretty. Sometimes it's necessary, and we can get a patient back to their former life. Sometimes we can flail on somebody for an hour. I know full well they're not going to make it. And there's a time where, and this is a tough subject, especially in a big room, when I've met you once 5 years ago, and the rest of you I haven't met. But there's a time when, as people of faith, we can let people move on. But that's very, very, very different than actively not treating seniors just because they're expensive. To me, they're worlds apart. I want to respect that patient. If they're saying, my body's tired, I've made my peace with God, I'm ready to go to heaven, don't put me through a fourth round of chemotherapy. That's okay. For the government to say that to Barbara Wagner, because physician-assisted suicide's cheaper, it's like a whole different deal.
Wow, these are very, very tough stirrings, if you will, as we approach these issues, and especially with the family in such crises right now. These are tender issues, and we're watching these populations age alone, and it makes it much more difficult.
Yeah, and I'm watching the breakdown of the family.
Right.
Instead of having a family that could come and say, where you know, as soon as you walk in the room, you know if it's a functional family where they all love their parent, versus a tremendous amount of guilt for all the crazy stuff they've done and that's displaced to anger. But another conversation.
Another conversation. Another book. Another book. And the final question I have before you show us the end of your presentation is, how do you treat current patients who cannot afford treatment under your care?
Well, another short question with an easy answer.
Make sure you're real.
Yeah. Well, for me, because of Medicare under reimbursement, my group went out of business. So I used to be a private practice physician, but we went out of business. So now I'm a hospital employee. So it changes the mindset, and there's more of that happening. Again, yet another discussion. But I actually never looked then, nor do I look now, at the payer source. So I treat everybody the same. I don't know if they're Medicare, Medicaid. Sometimes you can tell based on age what they're going to be. Or insured or uninsured. Unless in the conversation they're saying, Doc, I don't have insurance. Can we try and keep this cheap? And then I can say, well, there are things we can do to try and decrease the cost and have that discussion with them. And I wish we had time for policy, because there are solutions. And
you have been listening to Dr. C.L. Gray, founder of Physicians for Reform and a 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker.